Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a fizzing double shot of arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we step out of the shadows with Polly Braden's Untold Stories of Autism through a new exhibition of her photography. We catch up on the 9-day, 22-show explosion of the expertly made up that is Birmingham Improv Festival 2018, and we reflect on 50 years of politics, personal belief and progress as we catch David Edgar trying it on at the Mac. For more information on the show, the featured artists, and a full audio archive, go to www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with Out of the Shadows, an exhibition of photography, film, and text that charts the human cost of detaining people with learning disabilities and/or autism. To help explore this revealing, sensitive insight, I caught up with photographer Polly Braden and Becky Sexton from Multistory to help get a perspective. Okay, so I'm joined by Polly Braden and by Becky Sexton, and we're here to talk about a really intriguing, interesting exhibition, I think, here at MAC Birmingham. And Polly, let's start with the kind of theme. The exhibition is called Out of the Shadows, and it's the untold story of people with autism or learning disabilities.
Yes.
Okay. So let's start by how you came to that, because that's a big topic.
It's a big topic. Well, so 4 years ago, I started a piece of work about people with learning disabilities and autism, and about how they could lead fulfilling lives if they were given the right support. And that was a brilliant project. It was commissioned by a charity called McIntyre. And through that, I met lots of mainly the teenage boys were the ones that I was worrying about. And these are 18 to 20-year-old men, actually, transitioning from child services to adult services, who may have autism or difficult things, and just worrying, well, if they hadn't got this good support, what would they, you know, how would they have survived in society? It's just a big old task. And if people aren't around them to help them and guide them and understand them and guide them off the wrong path and back onto the right path. So I started investigating, and I read the Prison Reform Trust report, No One Knows, that says that 10% of people with learning disabilities are 10% of the prison population has a learning disability, and I thought, wow, that needs some work.
So I think that's one of the most challenging facts, isn't it, that comes out of this exhibition, that kind of prevalence of folks with learning disabilities or with autism, the prevalence within the criminal justice system. In the round.
Yeah, so to put that into context, in the general population, it's around 2.5% of the population who has a learning disability or autism. So that's an extremely high figure. And then you think, well, how are they managing in prison? And can they get through that system? And do they get out the other end, or do they keep reoffending? What is their trajectory through that system? And that's where it gets even more sticky.
Now, this exhibition has been commissioned by Multistory and is being presented, in partnership with MAC, with Midlands Arts Centre. And Becky, let's bring you in here to talk a little bit about Multistory and what that is. For our listeners, categorically, it's not a car park. It sounds like one, but tell us a bit about Multistory.
Yeah, so Multistory is a community arts organisation based in West Bromwich in Samwell. And we invite artists to make art with, for and about local people in response to their lives and experiences. So Polly approached us and told us about her research that she started. And as a big part of our work is about telling unheard stories through photography and art, we were really interested to collaborate with her on this.
So Polly, let's talk about some of those stories. Now, yeah. Most of the subject individuals, let's call them that, are, I suppose, in a state of education or in somewhere stuck in a care environment. How did you approach that in terms of capturing it, in terms of the lens on your art, as it were?
Well, they're not always the most beautiful places. It's actually not the most photogenic book, I would say, but the stories we're telling is the important thing. So sometimes it might be a case of going in close and photographing their hands, or it might be a case of finding some light within there and trying to make that work, or taking them to a new different room where they feel more relaxed, and just creating an atmosphere where you can do something a bit interesting. In Roy's case, well, I'll tell you about his. He's in a room that's painted a sort of lime green, which is the usual colour for an institution. But he also had lights that change colour, a machine that changes colour. So I used that to light his face, and so his face is a bit red, and the lime green looks a bit better.
Now, what I wanted to pick up on is initially, what I think is fascinating about your photography is initially, people might look at it and see, well, it's just a picture of a man on a bed. Okay, mm-hmm. Hopefully they won't all think that. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of depth, there's a lot going on, you know. So it may seem that someone is, you know, perhaps just sitting, resting or thinking, or, you know. The study and control of an environment, I think, is quite important, mm-hmm. particularly for some folks who have autism. And I think in Roy's picture, there are some really interesting things about Roy that you learn instantly. Now, what I'm going to tell the listeners is the pictures on the walls, for example, they're kind of part coloured in pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, and he's holding, I think, a tennis ball.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are all these kind of intricate details in some of your work. What I always find fascinating when I talk to artists is how you as a photographer, how you choose the images you use for exhibitions. So how you curate your stock, as it were. How do you approach that? Are there things that you find and you think that indicates or that links to the theme, or are there other things that you think you have to rule out?
Yeah, I think you're trying lots of different things when you're shooting, and then sometimes at the end you're doing lots of editing, but you actually probably knew when you took the picture that, oh, okay, I've got it now. If that was the moment, Roy at that moment is in the right environment for him, and it just worked. He told us a story about the tennis ball. He'd been explaining that, you know, he lies on his bed, and in fact, we'd been in the yard with him, and he was telling us about how he lies on his bed and throws a tennis ball against the wall, against his door, to relax. And so I was interested in that. He'd also been telling us about his colouring by numbers. So we just followed him. We let him kind of lead the way, and that's how we got to the picture that worked.
Now let's talk a little bit about the book, which I think the exhibition follows, and you touched on it earlier, which is, I think, called Great Interactions. Is that right?
So the first book was called Great Interactions, and this book that we're talking about is called Out of the Shadows.
Okay, and that's also the title of the
show.
The exhibition.
Yes.
Yeah. So the book itself is really a collection of around seven stories, I think.
So there are 10 stories
in there.
There are 3 told in the first person and 7, you're right, which are longer and more in depth. Yeah.
And some of that, as you said, some of those are told by those people themselves, and they're kind of, you know, sort of mm-hmm. Outlining their story. Mm-hmm. But you worked, I think, with the journalists to kind of help build some of the other stories or to piece together
aspects of it. Sally Williams came on board, and we went around to meet the people in the book with her for about a year. For about a year, we went back and forwards to meet Roy several times, and John several times, and Max several times. Well, Max's mum. We never met Max. Yeah.
So it's quite a lot of work. People think, I think, that photographers have got an easy life. They just take a picture, you know. But actually, the amount of work that goes into...
Also, you know, sometimes we'd turn up. So Rodney, for example, we'd sometimes turn up, you know, you'd drive 2.5 hours to Bristol, and you'd turn up and no one would have told you that Rodney had pneumonia and he's in hospital. Or you'd turn up and Rodney would say, oh, not today, mate. Or you'd drive to Birmingham and go to a long stay hospital and they'd say, oh, no, there's been some disturbances and you can't come in today.
Overall, we visited and photographed over 25 people in total, but we realised that in order to tell the stories well and do them justice, we should visit people over and over. So that's why we decided to focus on 10 people and invite Sally Williams, the journalist,
to really concentrate and hone in on those stories and really go deep into those stories and to tell the full story from every angle. But the other thing is that, you know, we went into prisons and gave workshops, we met with NHS England, we met with TISARD, we read reports, you know, it was a lot of work.
And how difficult was that to establish some of those trust relationships, I guess, that were necessary?
Extremely difficult. And the thing is that there are a few people who have been working on this for a long time, so Prison Reform Trust, TISARD has done a 3-year study following men coming out of prison. They followed 120 men, I think, coming out of prison to see what happens for them after prison, but none of those people were available for us to follow because their stories had been told, so we just had to find the stories. It was like finding a needle in the haystack. And then, you know, suddenly we'd turn up and hear this amazing story from Roy or Rodney, or, and you'd just be shocked, but there are a lot more out there.
And people had to be in the right place to share their story, didn't they? Which is why we ran these workshops initially, so they could choose whether they were ready to share the story and work with us in this way.
And they had to really understand what it was to be part of it, and the people around them had to understand what it was to be part of it, and everyone had to agree that, you know, this was a good idea for them at that moment.
It's interesting because a lot of the work, I think, it touches on safety as a kind of concept. Mm. You know, you can see from a lot of the images, they are safe or creating safe environments. And to explore those and to capture those, you've kind of got to let somebody into them. You know, that's an interesting dynamic, isn't it, for people, I think, in terms of, you know, their space and their environment. They have to kind of open that.
I think that's a very good point, yeah. And, you know, we're asking people to go into their bedrooms. That's a very private space and a very safe space. And we're saying, can we come in and take a picture of it? It's a big ask.
Yeah, you don't do it lightly.
So let's talk about the impact of the work, because that's another thing I'm interested in. In terms of, I think an exhibition such as this goes a great way to help kind of up people's understanding of and awareness of these kind of issues. So you mentioned some of the people you'd worked with through doing your research and your kind of your long journeys to capture people, as it were. How have they received what you've put together in terms of
the people themselves?
Yeah, well, yeah. So, and also the institutions, you know, so folks like NHS England, what's their response been?
Well, I think they've always been quite helpful, but also had other things to do, and you know, it took a little while to get their trust, I think, don't you?
Yeah.
And then as the project went on, they had some, you know, they had some things they wanted us to think about, and we responded. And consent was a big thing for us as well and for them. Mm. So that's been a continual process, checking consent, rechecking consent, going over consent, and making sure that's okay with all. And then there have been pockets of absolutely incredible people, like Wendy Goodman, people up in Birmingham, people in the Black Country, you know, have been very open. And they, without those people who open those doors, this project doesn't happen. I mean, that's just, and the trouble is, a lot of the prisons, they really never did open their doors to us. And if no one's opening their doors, then you don't know what's happening behind the doors, and that's a very worrying thing for people with learning disabilities. But this project, actually, when you look at it as a whole, we've been very, very lucky that we've got the access that we've managed to get. It's unusual and something to be really celebrated.
And you're doing a talk here this evening at MAC,
yes.
Which is, I guess, again, to help people sort of understand and explore some of the themes. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of popular thing at the moment, isn't it? Touring exhibitions, you know, there's a swirling kind of almost a scrum of activity that happens around an exhibition.
Well, I think, you know, an exhibition like this and a book like this, the point of doing it is to open up a discussion. We're not doing it to sit on our bookshelves. The point is to open a discussion, to say, has anyone thought about this? Can we think about this? So our aim is to get it out to as many people as possible and to get conversations started.
Excellent. So the exhibition is here at MAC until Sunday the 11th of November this year.
Yeah, yeah.
There are other places, I think, where people can find out about yourselves and your work. So one of those places is polybraden.com. Mm-hmm. You can have a look on there. And there is a sort of, there's another version of the book. There's some bits of the book which I think help give people a flavour of the book.
Okay.
Where else can people find out more about you and other than your website? Is that the best place to go?
So, well, we've got a piece coming out in The Guardian about the exhibition. So that's coming out, we're not quite sure yet, end of October. So it'll be a big piece. And then we have, you can look on Dowie Lewis's website, Dowie Lewis Publishing. And then, of course, Multistory.
Yep, which is multistory.org.uk. And the book's available to buy on our online shop as well. And you can get it in the MAC bookshop while the exhibition is here.
Excellent. I would urge folks listening to check out those sources. And until they do, Polly and Becky, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Out of the Shadows is at the Arena Gallery, MAC Birmingham, until the 11th of November. For more information, call 0121 446 32 3732, or you can go to macbirmingham.co.uk. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy, on 107.5 Switch Radio. And now a growing cultural cornerstone of the Second City. Birmingham Improv Festival 2018 celebrates its third outing with an array of acts and activities that are guaranteed to make you titter. Without preparation or script, I sat down to quiz leading protagonists John, Kate and JP.
Okay, so I'm here very excitedly with JP and Kate and John, and we're here to talk about the Birmingham Improv Festival 2018. Now, John, let's start with you, because you've already identified yourself as the ringleader. Yeah. And this is the third festival, I think, excitingly.
It is indeed. It's, third time we've done this. It's getting bigger and bigger each time.
You mean this?
And you've got some other people involved, some more partners involved this time to sort of ramp it up a little?
Well, so to date, we've always performed just at the Blue Orange Theatre, which is, I'm sure you know, a lovely little theatre in the Jewellery Quarter. But this year, Birmingham Rep have come on board. So there's three shows at the studio in the Birmingham Rep. Companies that were too big to fit into the Blue Orange, too big and too popular to fit into the Blue Orange.
That is a good excuse, isn't it?
No, it's true. One of them's already sold out.
Oh, excellent. A true excuse. Is even, yes. Even better, I reckon. So most of the acts that are involved in the festival are UK, local?
They're some local, mostly UK. We have one company coming all the way from New York.
Wow.
Because we're so special.
Even the number 11 bus goes that far. So let's talk to JP and Kate about some of those acts and some of that improvisation. Let's start, JP, with yourself. What kind of things will you be up to for the festival? Let's start with the brass tacks.
So, well, mostly I'll be an audience member. I'll be performing in a show with the Knee Jerks, who Kate and John are also a member of. John's pulling a face. Am I in something else?
No, he's not.
No.
He thought he was, but he's not.
I thought he was in something else, but he's not.
It's the art of making it up, isn't it? I think.
But we do know who's going to be in the shows. It is an improv festival, but it isn't like, oh, anybody can go on stage at any time. So me, Kate and John will be in the Knee Jerk. So we'll be doing half an hour on the Tuesday night, just getting a word from the audience and having fun with it and making sure everybody else has fun with it too.
So how did you, I'm interested in this, how did you come to improvisation? Because people think it's easy. Last time I met with John, I said to John, this is easy, isn't it? You just make it up. Mm-hmm. Okay, but there's a lot more to it than that. So how did you enter that world?
I started doing John's 8-week course at the Blue Orange Theatre 4 years ago. So I just decided that would be a fun thing to do with no view to performing or doing it. I thought it was just going to be a one-off, get me out of the house, meet some new people type thing. And John said at the start of the course, he said, you know, for some of you in this room, this will change your life. And I sort of went, yeah, right. I don't think so. This is very much a short-term commitment from me. But I really enjoyed that course and learnt a lot. And then John ran a level 2 course after that. So I did another 8 weeks. And then he said, well, you know, there's a drop-in in Moseley every week, come to that. So I started coming to that. The shows you can be in. So I started being in shows occasionally.
You never look back.
Yeah, it's just grown and grown since then.
And how about you, Kate? What sparked your interest in improv?
Nothing, if I'm honest.
Okay.
I discovered it by complete accident. I was not looking for improv. Improv came looking for me. I went on a date, and it just happened to be... It was a comedy night that we went to, and it was mostly stand-up, and it was like a Edinburgh previews kind of thing. And so we were watching a lot of stand-up comedy. And then just at the end of that bill... just sort of tacked on the end of this improv group, and I watched them, and I thought, yeah, that looks kind of fun, that looks good. They look like they're really enjoying themselves. I want to enjoy myself, so I went along, and I would say I'd never look back, but that's not quite true, because I was training as a teacher at the time. Teacher training kind of got the best of my life for about a year. I never forgot about improv. I remember about the fun that I had and how joyful it was, and I thought, I'm coming back to that. That's not going to get past me. So I went back, and since then I've never looked back.
There's a lot of parallels, isn't there, with teachers who are either comedians or improv
folks. Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. And I'm actually starting to learn dog training now, and there's a lot of parallels there too. It's all a Venn diagram.
Covers all the bases. Yeah. There we are. So excitingly, this year it's a 9-day festival.
It is.
9 days of improvisation. Is that possible, John?
Yeah, yeah.
Possible to keep it going that long?
Yeah, well, there's 22 different companies performing. So
so yes is the answer.
Yes, absolutely. So I spent a year scouring the world, well, scouring mostly Britain, going up to Edinburgh and finding all the best improv groups I could. And then combining them with all the local groups that don't get a chance to perform in prestigious festivals, and pull together this 22-show festival, yes.
So quite a feat, really, I'd imagine. Now, one of the key elements in any, I guess, any performance piece, but particularly improvisation, I think, is the audience.
Yes. Okay,
that scary cohort of people, the audience. Now, what I'm interested in is what the response has been in kind of the last couple of years in terms of, you know, people expect improv when they come, but, you know, what's their response in terms of getting involved, and how involved do they get?
It varies from company to company. So some companies, especially like Knee Jerks, we ask for a single word and then we do half an hour to an hour based on that. And some companies ask for a lot more. So for example, if you go and see Showstopper at the Rep, who do a 2-hour improvised West End musical for which they won an Olivier Award.
Wow.
An Olivier Award for a musical that doesn't exist if you think about it.
It's quite a feat, isn't it?
It is, because it's never been done again, that particular one. They get from the audience a title, and then they ask for genres of musical styles, West End show styles, you know, Hamilton, Sondheim, whatever. And then as they go through the show, they tick all those off and they do songs in every single style that the audience asks for. All improvised, with a band also improvised.
They also ask the audience for the title of the musical.
Yes.
So,
and is there a naughty list? Are there things you're not allowed to say or mention? Or
We leave that to people's conscience.
I think, John, you have a good rule here. When Box of Frogs perform, you normally say to the audience, if the funniest thing is them shouting it out, then what follows probably won't be any good. So if you think you're being funny to your mates, it's probably not very interesting. If you go to see a musical, it's like, do you really want to see a musical that's just stomped for 2 hours where we just die in life?
But that said, skilled improvisers can take terrible suggestions and still do really interesting things with them by taking it from an unexpected angle.
Now let's talk a little bit more about some of the specific acts. You said there's 22 acts over 9 days. That's quite a feat. And I was interested in Jumprov, I think it's
yes.
Pronounced. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Jumprov came out of 2016. Sunny Dapp, who had been to some of my classes, watched the 2016 festival and then pointed out to me what I'd already noticed, which it was very, very, very white. Improv tends to be, for some reason, a very white activity. It tends to attract white performers. Not completely now, and there are other groups with more diversity. But he went, we need to do something to counteract that. So he started Jumprov, which has only black and ethnic minority group members. And that's brilliant. So that's, as far as I know, they're the only UK improv group specifically set up to do that.
Excellent. Now, the other thing that caught my eye when I was looking at the great menu, as it were, things, were this idea of concept album. Okay, so a new concept album, improvised, live. My first question internally was, how on earth will that work? Because, as we know, all concept albums don't work. Okay? You've just got to listen to The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, and you know what I mean. But anyway, tell us a bit about that.
So they are coming as a bunch of musicians, plus projecting light artists. And they take a title from the audience and use that to create a concept album. So they just basically do a whole concert for an hour with music and songs and light show.
Do you do musical things, or are you unmusical in your improvisation?
I'm semi-musical. I have no musical talent, but I'm happy to sing on stage in improv. So the Box of Frogs group are also performing at this event. I'm not performing with them, even though I was getting a funny look earlier, but I'm really not. But they'll probably do some music, like very short scenes, not a full-length musical, but 3 to 5 minute things. Kate, you do.
Yeah.
You have actual musical ability.
I have some musical ability. Unfortunately, it's not singing. I can play the piano quite nicely, but singing is not something I've been blessed with, but it doesn't stop me. When Box of Frogs get the piano out, yes, I'll happily caterwaul along. But there are genuinely extremely musically talented groups that are going to be part of the festival. Showstoppers, North Coast. Have we mentioned North Coast yet?
No.
Everyone's coming from New York.
They're coming from New York. So doing actual musicals is Baron Stern Look, who will do an improvised musical, and Off Broad Street, who will also do an improvised musical, but it's not a narrative structure, it's a different kind of musical. And yes, the amazing North Coast, who have come all the way from New York, who do a hip-hop show.
Wow.
So it's not just hip-hop, they do scenes that then move into hip-hop with a live beatboxer who is amazing. Who's won awards for their beatbox ability.
I'm already scared by the idea of that, I think. You know, the idea of live hip-hop.
It's fantastic.
As in made-up hip-hop.
It's fantastic. I saw them perform in London, and they were so good, I said, would you please come back and come to Birmingham for the festival?
And they took you up on
in
it.
In fact, didn't you create a whole UK tour for them?
I have. The only way I could get them here. So the only way I could
being
get
modest
them,
there. Well, yeah.
Obviously, I couldn't afford their airfare, five of them, to come to Birmingham. So what I did was got in touch with people in London that I knew who do promote improv, people in Bristol and Edinburgh and Nottingham and several other places. And between us, we set up a whole tour for them. So I believe they're currently in London now. They're going to be in Bristol. And then on Saturday, I have a taxi standing by to pick them up at 5 o'clock in Bristol to get them here in time for their 9 o'clock show.
Wow. That's showbiz, isn't it?
I'm just hoping the taxi turns up.
Listeners should note that the limo has broken down, obviously, for that evening or something like that. So are there traditional themes, do you think, that always kind of persist when people go to improv events? On things, you know, the kind of trends that people say, oh, do something based on... You know, I noticed Enid Blyton and Shakespeare kind of crop in a lot, don't they? Kind of traditional stories or established...
Well, when most people think of improv, you know, a lay audience, most people think of Whose Line Is It Anyway? So a lot of it is kind of that. That's what people expect improv to be, you know, those kind of short, punchy, silly games and silly songs, which is great. You know, we happily do that. Box of Frogs do that style, basically. But I certainly think, because improv, it's a really hard sell sometimes when you're like, come and see this amazing thing. We don't know what it's going to be, but we know it's going to be really good. We're just going to make some stuff up. That doesn't really bring in an audience, whereas this kind of format thing, oh, we make up stories based on Harry Potter, or we make up stories based on Enid Blyton. It's a hook that the audience can kind of hold on to there, and they're, oh, I know what that is. I know that genre. I know what to expect when I'm thinking about an Enid Blyton story, for example. So it makes it a lot more accessible, I think. And so I think that's why you've got, particularly this festival, like the theme is themes, isn't it? Like each show, most of the shows are improvised particular genre. It makes improv more accessible and easier to sell, as well as more enjoyable potentially.
Now, John, you've already touched on this in describing some of the logistics for your taxi arrangements. Okay, but there's a growing kind of scene, isn't there? An improv scene. Mm. There are more and more groups. There are more and more kind of workshops and things cropping up all over the place. Do you think that's grown considerably since you started the festival kind of 3 years ago? Or
are you talking about Birmingham or the UK?
Well, just so, yeah, to start locally. So Birmingham's obviously getting bigger and better.
Absolutely. So when I started doing a drop-in 10 years ago, there was really pretty much nothing. We've now got at least half a dozen local performing groups. There are several people teaching. There's drop-ins you can do most nights of the week, so definitely, yeah, it's growing huge. Yeah,
but I think you can tie it back to festival, because you just said earlier, John, like Jumprov specifically came about by somebody sitting in the audience saying, like, here's that's inspired me to do something.
That's so true.
Now, there's also a criminal fraternity, I think. You've got a criminal show.
Yes.
Which is a kind of murder mystery. And again, I guess there's a bit of a Halloween link, isn't there, in some ways, about sort of murder and skullduggery and all that kind of thing. So tell us a bit about that. Is that something people should be worried about? Is that do the police need to be informed about that?
I think murder mystery is one of the more common improvised formats. It's a favourite format because with a lot of these shows, you take the genre and then you play with it. You know, so we all know what to expect from a murder mystery. We're going to expect suspicion. Everyone's suspicious. Everyone's got a possible motive. Everyone could have done it. Some rather strange ways of dying. The audience getting joining in, trying to work out how to do it.
It's always the butler, isn't it? Or the monster. If it's Scooby-Doo, it's always the monster, isn't it? I guess.
Yeah, but it's always the caretaker. Oh, the caretaker. The monster in Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I'm going to make a note of that. I think that's important.
Now, in some shows, the audience are allowed to decide who the killer is. So they pick a particular card or something like that. And then so the actors have no idea. Like, even when they've done the first half, they still don't know who the murderer is. And the audience decides at the start of the second half, potentially.
That turns the justice system on its
head.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
You look guilty.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I'm just finally just wanted to ask each of you is, a lot of people say to me, you know, I mentioned to colleagues and friends, I was coming to talk to you about improvisation and about whole kind of improv scene, and they're like, well, can you learn improvisation? And JP, you touched on sort of sessions and workshops and things you've been to, but some people say, well, the art of improvisation is not knowing, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? But there is something to it, isn't there? There's a structure to it.
Yeah, I think a terrible analogy, but I'll lean on it anyway, is you're learning to play together. And just like when you're very young, so I've got a younger sister, you know, you're not born perfect. You have to learn how to interact with others. And when improvisers are performing, they're playing together on stage and they're playing together in a nice way, in a way that helps each other build a scene and make something enjoyable for the audience. And your instincts when you first come to improv, you know, what gets you through real life isn't the stuff that will help you on stage. Being on stage, you might encourage you to be like more vulnerable, more honest, shutting up a bit more and listening to the other person, and being prepared to go somewhere that you really aren't sure what lies at the end of the path.
So, How about you, Kate?
Yeah, I would say it's less about not knowing, and it's just more about being so in the moment and in tune and being and listening and knowing about what's going on, and just being able to react to that constantly, moment to moment, just reacting to what you see. So it's not necessarily just getting on stage and being like, I know nothing. It's just like, I'm listening really hard, and based on what I can see and feel, I'm responding without having planned that in a previous moment. So yeah, it's really good for things like, you know, confidence and public speaking and, you know, all those kind of applicable skills as well. Mindfulness.
Excellent. The Birmingham Improv Festival 2018 runs from October the 26th, that's this Friday coming
Correct.
up, and it goes through to Saturday November the 3rd. And if folks want to find out more information and get tickets and those kind of things, John, you're going to help me by telling me where they should go.
www.birminghamimprovfestival.com.
Excellent. And there's a hashtag, which is BrumProv2018.
Correct.
I got it right. Thank you. So for now, enjoy the festival as it comes ever closer. But for now, John, JP and Kate, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Now, fancy a twist on a classic? Well, Lost Dog will present Juliet and Romeo at the Warwick Arts Centre on Wednesday the 7th and Thursday the 8th of November. It promises to be a clever, funny and tender production of dance and theatre. Check out more information at warwickartscentre.co.uk. Fancy a different kind of bark? Well, you're in luck. Birmingham Bark Choir will be performing Brilliant Bark at St Philip's Cathedral in Birmingham on the 24th of November. For tickets and information, go to www.birmingham.barkchoir.com. Welcome back to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. Now imagine meeting your younger self after a 50-year gap. Would you still think and feel the same about the world that swirled around you? Well, this interesting proposition was put ably by playwright David Edgar as part of his new performance piece, Trying It On. I caught up with David in between dress rehearsals and tried to get behind his intriguing new production.
I'm joined by David Edgar prior to his show Trying It On. And David, first of all, what are you trying on? Is it a great trick or is it an illusion?
No, it's none of these things. It's a double meaning. It's trying it on in the terms of clothes, but it's also trying it on in terms of doing something which you might not be entirely entitled to do, or might be a kind of new identity that you don't possess. And the play is about the fact that although I come from a very middle class, although theatrical, so ever so slightly bohemian, Birmingham background, I nonetheless got caught up in the great student upsurge of demonstrations and protests, particularly against the Vietnam War in the late 1960s when I was 20. And then I became a very committed left-winger, and that wasn't my background, and my parents both voted Conservative, although my mother in later life shifted around a bit. If your beliefs depart from your background and what you were born to, and your activity as well, because I've been a political activist intermittently through my life, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean to you psychologically? And I've written lots of plays about that, you know, about that theme in terms of fictional characters. But I've never really looked at it in terms of myself, except by the kind of refraction of writing a piece of fiction. And I'm 70 this year, and this is the last time I'm going to be able to do this. So I thought, why don't I do a solo show, which is a show that I've written and performed myself. So that's what I'm going to be doing this afternoon and this evening.
So you're kind of looking back to look forward, I guess, is one way of putting it.
Yes, and I mean, there is a kind of psychoanalytical element of that, you know, in that, and it's been very interesting. I've thought back to things that happened, and I've been back to, you know, stuff that I've kept from that era, and I've realized that for many years I've got things in the wrong order, and there's things that I'd forgotten which I'm, you know, delighted to have done, and quite a lot of things I've forgotten that I'm not delighted I've done. So to, you know, to some extent, it is a process of rediscovery of myself in order to perhaps go forward into the twilight of my years.
So let's talk about that chunk of time, that half century, that 50-year gap, if you like, in terms of the piece. So you're looking really back at 68, as you mentioned, which I think a lot of people see as a real sort of flashpoint year, kind of a moment where lots of reaction and revolutionary action, if you like, took place in different parts of the world.
And crucially, all around the world, and it felt really international. I mean, I was at the University of Manchester, which is, you know, a big and important university, but I mean, you know, it's provincial England. And you did feel that, well, that, you know, the students were occupying universities in America and in Berlin and in Tokyo, and there were uprisings in of young people in Mexico and in Pakistan. You did feel you were part of a global thing, and obviously one thing that gave that feeling was the music, because it was the high point of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they wrote songs which you know related to what was going on. You know, it did feel that we were all part of a same movement of really radical political but also social and cultural change.
Now, there's some real, I think, parallels in terms of what was happening in 1968 to what's happening in 2018.
I think that's true.
So you've got things, we mentioned the sort of the revolts, if you like, but you know, the Vietnam War is happening in 68. We've got all kinds of conflict going on significantly in Syria, perhaps. And you've got, I think, reactions to things around the Me Too movement at the moment.
I think Black Power leads to Black Lives Matter, the Women's Liberation Movement leads to Me Too, the Occupy movement now, you know, a few years ago, but that was really important, I think, for student activism. I mean, most of my friends who are university lecturers have complained for, you know, 30 years about how students are apathetic. They're not like we were when we were at university, but now, of course, they are like we were when they were at university, and there's a sort of, you know, a real upsurge of student activism. So I think the world feels much, much, and there's a rise of the right, and with the, you know, right-wing populism across Europe and Donald Trump and so on. And, you know, at the end of 1968, Richard Nixon gets elected, who was viewed then as a sort of unbelievably right-wing American president. And guess what's just happened? So I think that it's more like 1968 than it's been for probably since 1968.
And the crux, I think, of your show, of your performance, is really about questioning how you look back on that and whether you perhaps would respond differently or do
yes,
different things.
I did a number of interviews with people who, most of whom I knew, and one question I asked them was, you know, what would your 70-year-old self, what are you now embarrassed or ashamed about that your 20-year-old self did or said, and also, or believed, and but the other way around too, you know, what would your 20-year-old self be appalled by now? Hilary Wainwright, who's been an activist all her life and is very exemplary in that respect, she said, well, there's two things. One is my 20-year-old self would be appalled that I moved to London, and also that I joined the Labour Party, and other people, you know, had other interesting answers to that question, and that's the question I'm posing to myself.
Crucially, I think you're known and respected for being a director. You know, you're a theatre person, but you're a director and a writer.
I'm a playwright.
But not necessarily a performer. So this is one of the first times you're taking on a role yourself.
Yeah, or? I mean, there's a family joke that my mother, who trained at the Birmingham Repertory Theatre, and where she met my father, that my mother saw me playing Miss Prism in Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest at my all-boys public school, and responded, well, it's not going to be acting, is it, dear? Which I think is a gross calumny on my mother, though I think she would have quite liked to have said that. But the truth is that I acted at school, and I was able to do a lot of acting, which was one of the good things about school. I acted at university, where I read drama, and I think when I went there, I was thinking that I would be a stage director. And so I kind of came to writing by process of elimination, of discovering things I wasn't really very good at. So the last time I performed in a major kind of way was in a university production of The Mutiny on the Bounty, playing Captain Bligh, very bombastic. But really, from then on, I was just a playwright. I've been a university lecturer. I've spoken a lot at meetings. I don't mind speaking in public. In fact, I quite enjoy it. And so the opportunity of coming back and doing a bit of performing, you know, while I'm still compos mentis enough to do it, was rather attractive. So that was one of the reasons why it was an attractive idea.
So that's quite a role change, really, isn't it? For someone.
It is. I mean, it's my admiration for actors has increased a great deal because I'm using an auto cue, which we acknowledge, which means I don't have to learn it, which is a kind of terrifying thought. So the plays. Sort of nearly 90 minutes, a bit less. That's longer than the part of Hamlet. You know, if you read out just what Hamlet says, it'll take you about an hour and 10 minutes. So it's there's a lot of stuff, and I wasn't going to learn that. But I also learnt, because we made a film of it, which I found really interesting to look at, how it comes out of me and how it arrives at the public are two very, very different things. So I've learnt the sort of difference, you know, when you say bad actors, why on earth I've given them that note, why don't they, you know, do what I, you know, communicate it like I, you know, like I said, and they probably think they are, and of course good actors know what they look like, but it is very different from what it feels like when you're actually saying it.
Yes. How difficult is it to tackle history on a stage from a kind of personal perspective, a very personal perspective? Because I guess some folks will say, well, yeah, that was an interesting point, but it's not balanced, you know. So, how is that creepy?
Well, I mean, the balance point, I've never really, you know, a lot of people say that the theatre is a, you know, one-party state, as if the tabloid press wasn't. You know, I mean, the theatre does tend to be left-wing, and you could argue that it's because people in the theatre, you know, are involved with empathy, are involved with thinking themselves into other people's shoes, and that does lead you to have a, you know, a wider and more sympathetic view of the ambitions and needs and wants of the whole of humankind. It's certainly true that that's the case. This is, you know, overtly personal. It's interesting, I've just done a play, or revived a play, which I wrote in 1983, called May Days at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford, where I'm going to be performing this play. And that play is a kind of fictional version of my life story, with a very, very big change in what happens to my character when he's 30 plus. So it's been interesting to explore, as it were, the factual background of that play, and to realise, although I'm not known as an autobiographical writer at all, you know, how much of my work actually has an autobiographical element.
Now, while I was reading around the show and the performance, I found a great quote, and this quote was attributed to lots of different people, but one significant, Disraeli, okay, he said, "A man who is not a liberal at 16 has no heart. A man who is not a conservative at 60 has no head."
Yes, and that it's a slightly wider gap. Usually it's 20 and 40. And the line is in the play. Actually, it's said by somebody else who I was at university with and who was a very important mentor for me. And I was horrified to discover that 20 years later he'd become a Thatcherite. What the play's about is how you get rid of the bathwater without throwing out the baby. And I think there's a huge danger that you sort of slip into this wonderful, comfortable, warm bath of aging blimpdom, of you know, terrible expressions, and you know, and everything's political correctness gone mad, and the world's gone to the pot, and so on. And you cease to be interesting to anybody, particularly yourself. I feel very glad that I am still prepared. I'm still in a situation where I can applaud the Arab Spring, though be appalled by some of its outcomes. That I can be outraged by what's happening in Syria and elsewhere in the world. That I can understand, because I do understand, because I've been through and thought about a lot of it before. I can understand why right-wing populism is marching across the continent, and indeed across the continents. I can understand, you know, why people are voting for Trump, and you know, perhaps that's a useful thing to have. I mean, that knowledge. And if I'd, you know, moved to the right and was a Trumpist or a conservative or whatever, then I'd still have all that knowledge, but I wouldn't be putting it to any useful use. Whereas I think and I'm not the person I was, and there are lots of things that I don't believe. Notably, I don't believe there's going to be a revolution. I don't believe we're going to have a sort of massive apocalyptic change in which everything will roll back to year zero and start again. But on the other hand, I do think there is room for and importance for great social change, and we end this play with a rather sobering list of the dreams which come from manifestos and statements and Shakespeare plays and the Bible, of things that haven't been achieved and should be achieved.
So what's next for the play? You mentioned that you'd filmed parts of it or done some
yes, film. I mean, the film was in order to make a trailer and is not, it's actually a remarkably good film, considering how difficult it is to film stage shows. But I think if anything electronic did happen with the play, it would be kind of new. But we're looking, we're thinking as you do about bringing it back next year, touring it, and this run ends up with a run in London. It'd be nice to do some more. I've done a lot of dates in the West Midlands, which is my home, and I'm very pleased to do that. Possibility of talking about the Edinburgh Festival, and then the possibility of in some way giving it a permanent future through either radio or possibly film or whatever. So we're exploring all those possibilities. But it was certainly written to be performed by me, and therefore I want to keep that going as long as I can.
Well, the wonders of modern technology will allow us to come back in 50 years' time and consider and reflect on your performance this evening.
Well, absolutely. And what a horror! I mean, if you hear, early 20th century actors on sound or even on film, one's kind of horrified by the idea that was seen as being the apogee of acting. So it may be that my performance looks pretty horrifying today, but God alone knows what it looked like in 50 years.
Well, David, it's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been great. I've enjoyed it very much indeed.
Thanks for your time.
Not at all.
And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Polly Braden and Becky Sexton, Multistory and Mac Birmingham, John Trevor and the players at Birmingham Improv Festival 2018, David Edgar, Mobius Industries, and M7PR. The new Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.